You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of September 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, while Putin and Obama discuss the lingering threat of ISIS, Nigeria's new president misses a UN meeting devoted to Boko Haram. The theatre of world politics is well underway at the UN, but just how much puppetry is at play behind the scenes? I'll be asking my studio guests, Alessio Patilano and Martin Plaut. Then, why is the Italian Prime Minister calling for the world to accept Russia's place? And meanwhile, in Washington, is this the man to watch in the race for the White House?
But I do believe that we need a system which is not free college education for all. It is free tuition in public colleges and universities. I think it is simple. It is straightforward. It exists in other countries. And in fact, John, 50 or 60 years ago, it used to exist in the United States of America.
The popularity of Bernie Sanders is on the rise and Hillary Clinton is trying to work out how best to fight him. We'll try to give her some advice. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Cornwall Studies, the University of London, and hopefully once the traffic clears up, he'll be joined by Alessio Patilano, lecturer in War Studies, King's College, London. Welcome to you, Martin. And now, with so many of the world's most influential leaders congregating in one place, a mixture of theatre and politics is all but inevitable. The goal of today's gathering at the UN was to discuss strategies for defeating ISIS and other violent extremist groups, and it's the first time that Russia's Vladimir Putin has been joining in these proceedings. We'll discuss Putin's role at the UN General Assembly in a moment. But first, Marty, I want to talk more generally about the UN General Assembly and the way that it's this sort of piece of theatre sort of takes place over a period of days. And it is fascinating to have all these world leaders in one place at the same time, not just for what they say in public, but for all those meetings that take place in private too.
I think that's exactly the point. I mean, there really are two aims of the UN. The one is to, shall we say, put the seal of approval in bilaterals on deals which have probably been done before, and also to feel out the people that you don't know. And the second aim, of course, is to use the podium and the stage and deliver that set piece speech which goes right back to your audience back home and is just what they are wanting, expecting from you. So it's that duality of the UN summit, which of course must be, I mean, the summit must be a nightmare for ordinary New Yorkers who have their whole city taken over by these blooming presidents who scream around in vast convoys of with blue lights flashing. But still, it is an amazing event.
And yet, real theatre in the sense that every now and then they cut away to show the audience watching, and it's a bunch of, on the whole, sort of second tier diplomats, all quite bored, some surely looking at Facebook on their phones, looking up thinking, oh God, is the French president still talking?
Absolutely.
But they really are. They are speaking to their audiences at home, but also around the world.
They are, and people do listen, and it is a place to make your mark and make the big speech and say something. And the other thing, of course, is one of the big issues that has been this time has been the sustainable development goals. And I think they've been slightly overwhelmed by the other issues, but they are important and they are things that people can build on. I mean, after all, the Millennium Development Goals were an extraordinary success. I mean, something like 90% of all girls now go to school around the world. That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Things like the malaria has been substantially reduced. So when we do get together and use things like the United Nations to try and attain these joint goals, we work well. The one thing we have failed to do is to bring peace. And of course, that goes back to the very founding days of the United Nations when they were supposed to have an army. It never happened.
Is that, you think, one of the main problems the United Nations has had? Or is it actually, the fact is, there are 200 nations in the world. They are never all going to be able to get on. There is never going to be a central organisation that everyone is happy to give the authority to try and step in, to try and make decisions, particularly when there are big nations, be that America in the past or Russia right now, that really don't want that involvement.
Of course. And there are, of course, two separate forces in the world which are happening both at the same time. On the one hand, we get together. So, for example, the International Postal Union, which comes under the United Nations, absolutely vital, decides the kind of stamps that we use and how we swap information. The Communications Union, all these things, the law of the sea, these are vital bits and we can all agree on, come together. But at the same time, just as we have with the European Union, we have centripetal forces which are forcing us apart. So, you know, places like Britain and other countries, should we say Hungary, are now pretty unhappy with the European Union for exactly the same reasons. They don't believe they should pool their sovereignty, which is what you have to do with something like the United Nations, for a greater goal. So both things happen at the same time.
Now, we've had today various meetings about combating ISIS. And this is one of those issues where it's actually far more complicated than perhaps on the surface it really should be, because certainly the big players around the table, America and Russia, have very different strategies of how best to deal with this issue.
Absolutely, because, you know, for the Russians, they see this more or less as their backyard. I mean, after all, Syria isn't that far from the Russian border. It's only a couple of states away. Whereas for the Americans, this is a far-off land of which they know little, and with a bunch of Muslims that they think are anyway suspect. So what the heck, you know, you can do anything you like. So these are two totally different perspectives on the problem. But they do agree on one thing. They both think that Daesh or ISIS is, the pits and must be fought at every turn. But, you know, Putin has played a blinder in all of this.
Because, of course, yes, they might both agree that ISIS needs to be eradicated, but Putin's strategy is, well, look, therefore we need to bolster the one military regime inside Syria that actually has a chance of beating him. That is the actual government. That is President Assad. So therefore, we're going to give him weapons. We're going to give him hardware. We're also going to give him Russian military personnel to go and help him. Now, that's something that you're not going to see the Americans sign up to.
Absolutely not. And of course, it puts President Obama in a difficult position, because there's only so far that you can then go in attacking his forces without beginning to attack Russians on the ground. And imagine if Russian advisers were killed by American drone strikes. This would be a terrible situation. But of course, there is an agreement now on the Middle East, which nobody's really talking about, which is that the Arab Spring is now in the past. We now are back to where we were before the Arab Spring took place. We want the big boys. They may be bad, they may be sad, they may be terrible dictators, but we don't want democracy. It just isn't working.
You say that, but actually, is that a view shared by the US, by Britain, by France?
I think so. I mean,
because it's not shared publicly by them.
No, I mean, of course it isn't.
Prime Minister David Cameron, just yesterday say, oh, no, we still believe that, President Assad should go.
Well, yes, he says those kind of things. But, what are they doing to achieve it? Exactly nothing. Or next to nothing. I mean, all attempts to remove him have failed. You look at somewhere like Egypt, they now are quite frankly happy with, the system there. And they were very unhappy about the Muslim Brotherhood. Who are your friends and who are your allies? Who are the people who are sending, or radicalizing your youth back home in places like Britain, France and the other places? The Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamic, various Islamist groups. And so you go with the dictators who crack down on them.
There's a very different situation, though, between, say, Egypt, where the West can be like, well, look, we are essentially quite quietly giving them some military support. The US still gives $1.5 billion worth of military aid to Egypt. But they don't have to, help them, physically in terms of, taking on another group. There's that. And then there is a serious situation where America, Britain, France, others in the West have made it abundantly clear that Assad is part of the problem. for them to suddenly turn round, even quietly, and say, actually, we're going to work with him, or we're not going to fight him anymore.
Yeah, but then
that's surely very tricky for them.
Well, you know, they're quite good at making U-turns without making it look obvious. But I mean, they're now saying that perhaps he could have a temporary role in the transition. Well, that's very different from saying he's got to go. That's really a U-turn, in my view. But I mean, you know, it's not just the situation in Syria. Look at the relationship now that they've got with the Iranians. That is now much improved after the deal over the nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. So I mean, that is much improved. They're trying to bring the Iranians in. All our qualms about what kind of regime they had seem to be out of the window.
On that point, then, of working with Iran, we're still in this situation now where, the West is happy to work with Iran. That seems slightly easier, though, than the idea of working with Assad. That is still somewhat anathema.
Absolutely. Well, you can't move from, you know, sort of A to Z in one fell swoop. All I'm saying is that there seems to be a gradual acclimatization or an approach towards the Assad regime, which a few months ago would have been unthinkable.
I'm pleased to say Alessio Pasolano has been able to join us. Alessio, when you look at the way that the West relationship with Syria, that its approach to Syria has changed, you know, particularly over the last few months, and Marta was just talking about, you know, how he thinks that Putin has played a blinder in terms of its strategy and its tactics, certainly. What do you see as the next step for the West in how it deals with Syria, and particularly that issue of working with, or, you know, trying to avoid working with, President Assad?
I think there's two factors that have changed, and both of them have to be taken into account before we sort of venture into looking at how things will evolve in the future. First of all, I think sort of Western Europe and the United States approach to the issue, the one where sort of one way or another we try to say, like, really we can't work with Assad, etc., has been, you know, the bluff has been called out by Putin. I mean, pretty bluntly. So that changes the game, as you mentioned. But there's another sort of element to this, which I think is quite relevant as well. From the perspective of for European countries, and especially for top countries within the EU, the question of one of the side effects of the Syrian crisis, particularly the question of the migrants, is becoming a very palpable, serious, major issue. So I think they're coming at that this UN meeting with a slightly different mindset. They understand that you can't just wait and sort of try to see whether there are other options. You need to do something. You need to get something out of it. I think Angela Merkel is one of the leaders, but it's not the only one. I think many are looking at this important encounter as something of a political necessity. They have to strike good points back home. People are waiting to get an understanding of where we're going with this.
I want to move on from ISIS and ask Martin, do you think that actually the attention that there has been on ISIS, obviously, you know, there is only so much attention that diplomats can give to certain issues, you know, before others get crowded out. And we've seen, you know, Boko Haram shift off the agenda. We've seen the Taliban shift off the agenda. And yet both of those have now been discussed quite heatedly in the UN today because, of course, firstly, there was a meeting about Boko Haram, which it turns out the Nigerian president didn't show up to. And now it seems that the Taliban has seized its first major city in Afghanistan since 2001. Is this because we're focusing too much on other things?
Well, I mean, I think they're two very different situations. I mean, the fact that the Nigerian president managed to miss that meeting is quite extraordinary. I mean, I phoned some of my contacts in Nigeria this afternoon and nobody really had a good explanation for this. But extraordinarily, it wasn't the only meeting that he missed. Mm. Do you know that he missed his meeting with the Pope as well? Because apparently he was taken to the wrong door, the door that was not for presidents, and he couldn't get in. They wouldn't let him in. Now, exactly who did this, but the
people well, they've probably been fired now. Whoever they
well,
are. If they're lucky, they've only been fired.
That is what is being considered. Apparently, the person who might have been behind this was the permanent representative at the United Nations of Nigeria, Joy Ugwu, and it's possible that she was the person who, you know, what these people are, especially Nigerian, you know, politicians are, have egos the size of mountains, and you know, it's quite possible that she just couldn't be bothered to, you know, be worried about these kind of details. I don't know, but it was.
I'm
it,
glad
it's been
a
humiliation.
Ruby said that rather than me. On that issue, Alessio, of the Taliban, how significant do you think this this seizure of Kunduz is?
To be honest, I think that the situation wasn't really improving. I mean, we just sort of, we didn't hear too much about it for quite some time. The situation on the ground is pretty grim. It's not particularly, it's not looking good. There is a substantial withdrawal of military forces that can sort of mount a degree of challenge in a coordinated and sustained fashion. So it's not entirely striking. And I think there is all these problems, these major international security issues that you mentioned, they do all have something in common. And that is, ever since the massive withdrawal of forces from Afghanistan has some sort of been coming across a signal, a message that Western European countries and the United States are not necessarily militarily convinced to back their words in terms of taking actions in whether it is North Africa, Middle East, Afghanistan. And I think now we're starting to see the effects. These are cracks in the wings of a plane that is being shaking and sort of going through rough weather for quite some time now.
And Martin, this is, you know, surely partly a consequence of not being able to bring the Taliban into any sort of national government or sort of coalition earlier, when there were discussions about peace talks and how do we engage with the Taliban.
Indeed, but one of the odd things that I mean, I simply don't understand why those talks didn't get any further. But, you know, the Afghan situation has been, shall we say, a mystery to the outside powers ever since the British Raj. I mean, you only have to read things like Kim by Kipling, and you will see incomprehension as whatever happened in Afghanistan. So there's a rich and lengthy history going back a couple of hundred years of the outside world not understanding Afghanistan. And, you know, there's nothing new about this.
On that point, Alessio, is this, can you see over the coming years, you know, Western interest in Afghanistan, you know, waning to the extent where, you know, frankly, no one really cares how much, you know, which group is in charge, what's happening here or there. There'll be the occasional, you know, human rights story about abuses by, you know, a particular leader. But frankly, you know, if the West, as Martin's suggested, has tried many times to do stuff in Afghanistan, has always come off worse.
I think this is already happening, actually. And if you look across sort of general interest in what is happening in the region and particularly in Afghanistan, it has decreased massively. I'll give you one small example. We run one of the largest postgraduate programs on South Asian security. And one of the reasons why we set it up in the first place was the importance of that understanding sort of regional politics in Central Asia and the connection with South Asia for Afghanistan and other bits and pieces like that. That was the main requirement. And we had a massive numbers for about until last year. This year, for the first time, numbers have gone substantially down in that respect. And I think that is very telling. When the general audience's attention shifts away to something else, then it's very difficult from a political point of view to invest capital into keeping the momentum.
And lives.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And there's also the added value that the entire sort of this Afghan war, and if we go back to the historical example, this is very much similar to what happened in previous British experiences. The attention goes away because there isn't a fully sort of a clearly articulated answer as to why we were there, what we've achieved, and what difference can we make. So if you don't have those premises, it's very difficult to keep the political attention in that particular place.
I mean, if anybody wants to see this, go down to Canterbury Cathedral in the south of England, and look at the walls. There are monuments to people who died in exactly the same places as the current troops died, you know, 10, 15 years ago, except they're 100, 150 years. Exactly the same places.
Absolutely.
Nothing has changed.
We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and my guests, Alessio Pasolano and Martin Plaut. Up next, why is the Italian Prime Minister calling for the world to pay more attention to Russia? And is Bernie Sanders the one to watch in the American presidential race? Stay tuned.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Alessio Pasolano and Martin Plaut. Another leader ready to air his thoughts to the world at UN this week is Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. As part of an interview that touched upon the country's stance on the Middle East and even reforms in the nation's Senate, Mr. Renzi said that if Western leaders wanted to end the carnage in Syria, they must accept the central role of Russia in world affairs. Alessio, I'll come on to you in a moment for a sort of more of a historical perspective on Italy and Russia. But Martin, Matteo Renzi has a point here. Russia needs to be, as we were saying before, Iran needs to be involved. Russia needs to be involved if there is to be any outside solution on Syria.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no way that the Russians, who are a major world force, and can be ignored. And I think that this was one of the mistakes at the end of the Cold War, is that the Americans thought, we've won. In fact, said so. They said, we've won. There is only one superpower. No, there aren't. There are at least two superpowers. And in fact, power is draining away to three superpowers. And the third one is, of course, China.
Are China and Russia, sorry, I don't really want to get into our China and Russia superpowers, but come on, they're not really, are they? They're regional powers.
No, I don't agree. I think that they are superpowers. They have an ability to project themselves and are increasingly projecting themselves across the world.
Can I just take the middle ground here? And I'd say that they're not necessarily a regional power because they do have a political influence and economic influence that yield far beyond their regional, immediate regions. But I wouldn't call them global because I don't think at the moment they have a clear ability to sustain political, economic influence and impose costs on people that don't respect it with military means as yet.
I just want to ask you, Alessio, about Renzi making these comments about Russia and Russia's role. Italy's stance towards Russia, it's fair to say, has been a bit more nuanced than, you know, countries further west, you know, the UK and the US in particular. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, there's the personal element to it. Matteo Renzi has been presenting himself all across the political landscape in Italy and in Europe as a kind of guy that will not hold it back, will tell you things just up front. That's part of his strategy. That's how he's likable. He's also relatively young, so he's almost allowed to say things that other people cannot do and say. And so in this respect, as you said, Steve, is it telling the sort of a lie? No, he isn't. I mean, one has to take Russia back into that diplomatic discussion. And the fact that we waited too long, we're paying now the consequences of military assets already being deployed in Syria. So I think that's one of the elements. But there's something more to that. And I think it transcends Renzi's own persona. And that goes to sort of a certain understanding in Italy based on relatively strong ties. During the Cold War, the Italian Communist Party, it was one of the strongest and most connected communist parties, communist movements. And even before that, I mean, you can go back to the early sort of a very special relationship between the Italian and the Soviets. They date back in the 1920s when Stalin fell in love with Italian cruisers and had Italian architects going back to Soviet naval bases and work with dockyards. And from then, we see even from British records that Italian intelligence on the Soviet Union was quite good. And as a result of that, you have this political, economic, long-term ties being developed. And as a result of that, I suppose also an appreciation of how far the sort of Soviet and Russian sort of tentacles can reach out in certain regions of the world, Middle East being one that is very close to Italians' interests.
Okay, just finally, let's be honest, no one really ever considered that a self-proclaimed socialist would be a serious contender for the White House. But while Hillary Clinton struggles to maintain the once invincible momentum of her campaign, Bernie Sanders, for it is he, is striking a chord amongst young people, and perhaps not even young people, not even just young people as well. A recent poll found that voters aged between 18 and 34 put favourability of Mr. Sanders at around 47%. But when it comes to who's more honest and trustworthy, Sanders is perhaps even more so than Clinton, 10 points ahead. Martin Plaut, is socialist less of a dirty word for Americans now?
I don't think so, but Bernie Sanders seems to come across extremely well. And, you know, he's up now at about 28%. Hillary Clinton's at about 41%. Her polls have been sliding. There's even suggestions that she's going to lose Iowa, which would give him tremendous, start in the race. Would he be able to beat, shall we say, Donald Trump if Trump turns out to the Republican? Can
Sanders
you imagine?
V. Trump. Let's not
I know, it's a
that.
Wonderful idea. Well, who would have thought that you'd have Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party in Britain? Anything is possible.
What's interesting, Alessio, is that there hasn't been a Sanders v. Clinton debate yet.
Mm.
Or, let's not forget him, Martin O'Malley as well. In the sense that, you know, the Republicans have had 16 people out on a stage. You know, it's been this big circus. Everyone knows what's going on. This has been much quieter, but also much more isolated. Clinton here, Sanders there, never the two together.
Well, I think, first of all, if you have a more fragmented audience, the Republicans at the moment, they have to reorganize their rank and files. They have to prepare themselves. So it is important to have the kind of confrontation, particularly because you've got so many candidates. So debates, it seems a logical choice in that sense. On the Democratic side, what I think is quite interesting is that the Clinton clique seems to be powerful, politically connected, quasi-independent. That's part of the reason why perhaps Hillary is not as likable as other candidates. They seem to be slightly removed from the everyday person, the person on the street, the sort of likely person to go and vote for the Democrats. And I think that's why you have this idea, as you were saying, sort of being self-contained and separate. I think at the end of the day, regardless of whether Bernie Sanders will actually gain traction or not, I think what is important is that these voices are a reality check for those who are at the front. They have to come to terms with certain realities. I think that's the key element here.
What's interesting, Martin, is that there has been something like this going on now for more than a decade in the US. First of all, in the 2004 race, you had Howard Dean, also from the Northeast, from Vermont, who was, this sort of the left's big hope. He was against the Iraq War. He was against bankers. He was, he was on the left. He then obviously burnt out somewhat. But Barack Obama managed to also, fight an established figure, that time Hillary Clinton as well, by being the left's new hope. I mean, in a very different way, a far more polished way, but he was that figure.
Absolutely. But I think there's something else, which is that there is something peculiar about Hillary Clinton. There is something she's not, doesn't seem comfortable in her own skin. And she comes over as somebody who has something of the night about her. There is just something peculiar about her, which is not absolutely... the fact that she's had all these strange emails and all these... There's endless stories going back to her funding years and years ago. There's something that's odd about her.
Is it actually, Alessio, that she's the sort of person that is far more comfortable governing than running to govern?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly... She's a strong person, and, you know, for a woman in a business whereby the majority of your counterparts are male, you need to be strong. And I think she's absolutely sort of... She gives that aura. But you can't be strong and at the same time, at the beginning, provide this sort of that glow of warmth that everybody sort of wants to aspire towards and which makes you gain sort of votes in face of an electoral challenge.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Alessio Patilano and Martin Plaut. Thank you to you both. Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federica Romaniello. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Matt Allagaya is here next. Then it's Josh Fennett at 1900 with Section D. We're back same time tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London. That's 1300 if you're listening in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.